Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Paul Gann, alongside Jeremy Espy. And for the next 2 hours, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, you will get a heavy dose of our opinion. If you have an opinion, the number's to call. 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. You can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/Gann. That's blogtalkradio.com/Gann. You can send emails to the show, goforward.gann@gmail.com. That's goforward.gann@gmail.com. Expected to be joined by actor, writer, director, Quinn Smith. And Quinn, if you remember, played Lupus on the Bad News Bears, the original Bad News Bears. And those guys are coming together for a Bad News Bears reunion movie, so Quinn is going to talk about that. And also expected to be joined by WBC welterweight champion Andre Berger as he prepares for his upcoming fight April 16th against Vicious Victor Ortiz. So it should be good to get Andre Berger's thoughts on that upcoming fight against Vicious Victor Ortiz. Jeremy?
Oh.
How are you
doing, man? You know, we're in the middle of a NCAA tournament and the NFL lockout, so I got all feet to the burner here.
And day 15 of the lockout, right? Yes, day 15. Turns off. It would go this long. But again, not to worry, not to fret, not to get upset. It will get settled. No games will be missed. These players and these owners are not stupid, and they will take care of that. And speaking of talking about the lockout, Leonard Weaver, Eagles fullback, might have put his foot in his mouth earlier this week. Not might have. He definitely did put his foot in his mouth. talking to Derek Gunn of Comcast SportsNet in Philadelphia, here's his Weaver's quotes. We as players want to make a statement that, you know what, we love playing for you all. We love your owners, you know. We love you guys very much, but at the same time, we need to see some equal opportunity here and stop treating us basically like Adrian Peterson said, like slaves. Leonard, my man, you were doing well until you talked about plays and that whole thing. Anytime you hear that word, it gets people a little nervous, and it's just, that's all everybody focuses on, is that word. And Leonard, you have to understand something, my man. You're making a lot of money. You're making a lot of bank, Leonard. Up $2.5 million you're scheduled to make next year. You make bank. You make money. So you're not a slave. This is not slavery. This is not slavery, my man. He later apologized, and rightfully so. But, I mean, come on, Leonard. When unemployment is this high, when individuals are losing their homes and all this other mess, you're talking about slavery when it comes to million-dollar men. You're talking about slavery when it comes to millionaires battling billionaires. You're talking about slavery during a recession. We're out of the recession, but it was the recession was bad. The economy is bad. The economy may take another dip. So you're talking about all these things when we have all these things going on. Leonard, people are not going to You're talking about slavery, Leonard, and you're talking about when we have a bad economy. You're talking about slavery, Leonard, when you make millions and millions of dollars. Yes, I understand football is a tough game. Yes, I understand that your shelf life is only so long. I understand all that. Yes, you may feel like you're not treated too well. Hey, maybe you're not. But guess what, my friend? Not too many people can say that they can make $2.5 million a year. Not too many people can say it. Not too many people have the opportunity to do it. And you're playing a kid's game, which is football. Leonard.
I mean, Paul, you know, you're bringing up an interesting point. I mean, yeah, okay, they're quote-unquote professional athletes only because we've allowed them to be called that. I mean, these are people, lay people, many of them, Paul, let's keep it real, with very little to, if any, post-secondary education, and all of them that we're going to speak about, you know, Adrian Peterson, Leonard Weaver, all of them are making, like you said, multi-millions. I have a very large problem when anyone in any professional arena, especially an athlete, is going to liken their situation, because they're not the ownership, liken their situation to a slave, especially considering the last time I checked my history book, a slave was held against his will. I don't really see anyone holding Leonard Weaver against his will. You know, if he is so, to me, if you want to make a statement, be a Jim Brown. You know, be a Barry Sanders. Walk away from the game at your peak and never look back. Don't sit here and criticize.
If you feel that way.
Well, but he obviously does. I mean, Paul, he comes out and apologizes because he's an idiot. I mean, because you say something so asinine that obviously, you know, his PR people told him. I mean, listen, we're in the middle of the strike. It's day 13 or 12 at that point, whatever day it was.
15.
Well, I'm talking about when Leonard Weaver made his comment. But obviously things may be tenuous. But again, like you said, Paul, I mean, Leonard Weaver, when the strike is settled, whether it's this year or 2 years from now or in 2 days, Leonard Weaver's making $2.5 million next year. So a slave that makes $2.5 million, I can say this, you can count me in. I'll work on Lincoln Financial Park's plantation because I find that to be one of the dumbest, most uneducated comments or comparisons that these athletes are now trying to make, which is, you know, they're quote-unquote almost trying to look like a victim or look like they're being held hostage by an ownership group. If they feel that way, then why don't they go and pursue other avenues of their life that will be either more fulfilling, equally as fulfilling, but certainly, you know, with much less to do.
And the reality of it is, Leonard Weaver made $2.9 million last year. I think that's kind of enough said. You make $2.9 million a year, darn near $3 million a year. Yes, you have a responsibility to feed your family. Yes, you only have so long to play this game of football. Leonard Weaver is coming off a gruesome knee injury. So, yes. There is only a limited opportunity to make a limited amount of money. Yes, I understand that, Leonard. But, Leonard, if done right, you can pocket this money for a long time to come, invest it right. If everything is done right, Leonard, you can set yourself and your family up for a long time. There could be generations upon generations of weavers eating very well if you can do this thing right and make everything right. But the reality of it is this. Not much sympathy you're going to get from the general EOQ public right now. It's just you're not going to get it. Football is there to entertain us. Football is there to make us happy. Football is there for us to compete in fantasy football and suicide pools. Football is there for civic pride. Football is there for all those things. That's what we care about when it comes to football. We don't care, and people, yes, you know, I understand. I don't understand because I've never played football, but you can see the pounding. You see it's evident in a lot of these players. Andre Waters in his situation, so many concussions, it led to his demise. Dave Dorson, a guy, committed suicide right now. They're trying to figure out if that came from some kind of brain injury. So, I mean, so we see the toll that it takes on a person's body, and we also see that many times a lot of these guys go broke, as we saw in Real Sports with Chidi Ahanotu and Luther Ellis, two guys that made some good money in the NFL, but now are broke, and now are struggling at this point, and now are trying to find other ways to make money. I see that, and I understand that. Hey, I understand. I mean, you know, one thing about football, unlike basketball or baseball, is the guaranteed contracts, and that's very important. I mean, because, yes, Leonard Weaver is scheduled to make, I believe, $2.5 million next season, but there's a good possibility Leonard Weaver could be cut, and he sees none of that. I understand all that. And it makes you will definitely understand all that. But the reality of it is, if Joe Q. Public, guy making 40, 50, 60 grand a year, is not going to have the sympathy for you who's making $2.95 million a year. No one is going to have that kind of sympathy for you that you're looking for and that you may want. Now, granted, I do sympathize, and because you understand that the football shelf life is only but so long, 3.5 years is the average career. So you got to make all the money you can in that limited amount of time. That's why in a lot of ways I am pro-player with all this mess and all this lockout mess, because the reality of it is the owners will continue to eat until the cows come knocking, and they'll continue to find ways to make money. The players, not always that easy, not always that simple. And again, they may not see a lot of these things. They may not see the amount of money that they want to see or they would like to see because of injury and because of other things that's involved in the game of football. So, I mean, I understand all that, and I understand where Leonard Weaver is going with all this, but you have to be careful with the words that you use. You got to be careful. You got to be careful with the words that you use. Because as in this situation, the situation with Adrian Peterson, it comes back to bite you in the butt. It comes back to bite you in the butt. And now people are like, what is this guy talking about? What is he talking about? Leonard Weaver is a guy who does a lot of work in the community, gives back, a charitable guy. He's definitely, though, he's a good guy, one of the good guys in the game. But Leonard, you got to be smarter when it comes to certain things and when it comes to expressing your opinion on certain things.
It almost makes you wonder, though, Paul. I mean, if sometimes I don't necessarily know what you would wind up calling them per se, but maybe the term special interest groups for these players are, you know, I guess maybe putting buzzwords, in the players' ears, to certain regards, maybe even inappropriately, because here again, I mean, I just think that you can't say that. You just can't. That's not something that you, as a person, and you made a very strong point. Like, you know, Leonard Weaver is not, he's not a guy out there that, you know, you see in the clubs getting in trouble, saying outlandish or outrageous things, but you just have to, as a person, and especially as an African-American male, I think the onus is also equally as important. I just don't think you're out there saying to people, comparing the plight of a professional athlete who literally is on strike, by the way, that they could have taken, if they really wanted, you know, to work, I keep going back to saying, if it's so objectionable to be a professional athlete, if you really look at your situation akin to slavery shit, and there's no way killing you to be there, then quit and retire.
You're right. I mean, you're absolutely, totally right. You know, you're right. I mean, that's all you can say. You're right. I mean, the reality of it is, again, no one.
Too many young kids are listening to, that mantra. And to me, again, I think that there needs to be a level of culpability to these players, and you know, to anyone in the public medium, so to speak, that would hear someone say something like that, because you're really, I think there's very little that when you hear something like that, that's left to the imagination. I mean, you know, when someone says that, what they're referencing, you know, the fact that that they are, to a very large degree, you know, holding a gun now, saying to the owners, you know, we want to be freed of our tyranny. But again, I mean, no one is holding them. They're asking for public empathy, but like you said, Paul, they're really, you know, I think it's going to be very hard to find someone saying, you know what, Leonard Weaver, we agree with you. You know, this Eagle organization is a micro, and certainly the NFL is the macro. You know, they really are doing a disservice to you, and we should step in and get involved, because the $2.5 million they're going to pay you next year and your colleagues who make $50 million coming out of college, it's just totally inappropriate. You should be making way more than that.
And just to read the reality of it again, and I hate to kind of belabor the point, but in terms of sympathy, you know, A, you're not going to get sympathy from Joe Q Public. I mean, people really don't care, you know. I mean, and also, you make a point. I mean, no one forced Leonard Weaver to go on this playing field, or as, if he wants to equate to slavery, the plantation, if you will. No one forces Leonard Weaver to go on the plantation, a.k.a. the field. No one forced his hand. No one pulls his hand. No one's grabbing his hand. No one is telling Leonard to get on this ship and take this ship to Philadelphia and go on Lincoln Financial Field eight Sundays out of the week and eight other places throughout the country, 16 games a year. No one is telling you to do that, Mr. Weaver. No one is telling you to bang into another man for 16 games a year. No one is telling you to do that. You have made the decision to do that. You have made the decision to say, you know what, I'm going to Philadelphia. I'm going to wherever. And guess what? I've decided that I'm going to play football, and I decided that this is a risk I am going to take. So if I bang my head into this and I get my leg twisted this way and my leg twisted that way, that is what you decided to do. And you get paid handsomely, very, very well. You get paid very well to do that. You get paid very well to do that. But don't equate yourself to slavery, and don't call this modern-day slavery. So if Leonard Weaver is a slave, I wonder what a teacher or a factory worker is, or an accountant or anybody out there. I wonder what they are. I really do. If Leonard Weaver is a slave. Do you have an answer there for me, Jeremy? I mean, Weaver is a slave...
You know, but let's take a step. I mean, I think we're kind of beating a dead horse in Leonard Weaver, but it gets back to this macro point of, I think these players in certain regards do have to remember. I told you this last week, and we kind of got into it, Paul, about, you know, I think where, let's say, where the line is drawn between, you know, the quote-unquote the player and the owner, and I very strongly believe that some of these players are totally misrepresented in the mindset that they, because certainly, yes, fans do not go to an NFL stadium to see Jeffrey Lurie, to see Al Davis, to see, you know, any of the owners. They are there to see the Donovan McNabbs, the Peyton Mannings, and the like. But to that end, and very, very simply put, by the same token, you know, these players, they are not the ones who have all they do is hone their craft. They do not make, you know, these deals with the TV stations. They are not working at the NFL, you know. The logos and the advertisements and broadcasting, you know, their games in other nations, they're really not worried about the true quote unquote business aspect of the NFL. So if you certainly look at you know, Pete Rozelle, to be a quick minute or a sermon on, you know, the economics and certainly the business growth of the NFL under Roselle and then essentially Paul Tagliabue, you know, that's where you really look at how the NFL grew. I don't really see even the great Reggie White, who, yes, opened up free agency for the NFL and made it more, let's say, league competitive, but what he did pales in comparison to, you know, the AFL, NFL merger, putting the games on TV, negotiating the contracts. Even in the last 7 years, the startup of what is now the biggest juggernaut in the NFL growth, which is themselves, the NFL Network. And they're, you know, essentially the NFL Network is a 360-degree, 365-day a year juggernaut. I mean, it's destroying, you know, the growth of even ESPN, where who would have thought that, Paul? And that had nothing to do with the players.
Well, in terms of ESPN, I mean, that is the ultimate golden goose, and, you know, nothing's really going to – right now, I mean, ESPN controls a lot of different entities, and there's no stopping that machine at this point. But the NFL Network is something that owners conceived the idea, and it was a good idea if you ask me. I mean, football is king. Everybody loves football. People want to see football or hear about football 365 days a year. And the NFL Network does that.
And what? And Paul, when we look at that, and I mean, certainly as a former, you know, ESPN employee yourself, you recognize probably better than anybody. You know, the players have very little to do in the brain trust of creating that entity. Yet they want to reap the benefits only because it's their faces that are plastered all over, which, don't get me wrong, Paul, their faces certainly count for something, but I mean, really, their faces count for that much?
Well, I mean, let's be real. Football is not football without Peyton Manning, without Tom Brady, without, I mean, people come to see those guys. Right. People come to see those guys. And so, I mean, let's not get that.
Yeah, but they're gonna come, and you know as well as I do, they're going to come for now will be Matthew Stafford, and this year it's gonna be somebody else. There's always going to be new athletes. That's the point of
yes, true. And if these guys came out today and said, you know what, I don't want to play no more. I mean, yes, it would take some time, but there will be a new crop of people coming out and wanting to play football. Yes. If Peyton Manning says, I don't want to take $12 million, but I'm not playing for $12 million. I'm sure there's somebody out there who will come out and play for $12 million. If the owners put down a new CBA, and this new CBA is pro-owners, but, you know, players are still able to eat and still able to make big-time money, there are going to be players out there who ultimately – go after it and take that money. But I think what's good right now from a player's perspective is right now they're pretty unified. Right now they're all on the same page. And, you know, when you're unified, all together, all on the same page, that looks good for you. And that's good. That's a good situation for you. And right now the players are unified. The players are together. The players are really one. What they want, and they're going to wait and see what happens and negotiate, or the courts, at this point, the courts will handle what's going on and decide what's going on. And right now, that's going to be April 6th, actually, this week. A judge will hear Brady or the NFL players against the National Football League. And so Tom Brady's the lead plaintiff against the National Football League. And this is basically for the players to ultimately stop the lockout right now and ultimately get something done. They want to stop the lockout. They want to continue business as usual. So, I mean, we'll see what happens. We'll see what the judge does in this particular case and to see if this whole thing can get taken care of. But, I mean, right now, if they go to court, they get the injunction, and they stop the lockout, I mean, I guess ultimately they still would have to come up with something. They would still have to negotiate something and still come up with something. But who knows? Who knows? I mean, this could take a long time.
Well, you say it's going to suit me. You're the champion that not to worry that it's going to get done. And I told you, Paul. I'm not disagreeing. I mean, this is certainly you know going to get done on a level. I'm telling you, I just have to believe history will show you that this is not very. This does not bode well. These kind of strikes where they are, it's a what I'll consider, you know, the biggest, this is the biggest day for a lot of these athletes and owners in their respective lifetime. I mean, the bottom line is people want, in play in all this, the players and the owners, they all believe that they need to make amends for the prior deal. You hear the owners saying that they want a greater piece of the current revenue. And the players are saying, well, we're not giving you that, and we want a piece of the back end. So I think that in every report you hear, you know, listening to how far off everyone is, we may very well be well served to trust that judgment. Because I said to you, Paul, I think the players are very off base. I know it seems unorthodox to say that or unconditional to believe that. I think the players really need to look at this more objectively and say, I mean, yes, don't get me wrong, the NFL has grown because of the Peyton Mannings of the world, but by the same token, I mean, the NFL is not a Peyton Manning league. No professional sport will ever be a slave, if you will use that term, to any player. Even the greatest player in the history of professional athletes, modern time, Paul, we don't have to argue over of a name like Michael Jordan. I mean, which he redefined an entire sport. He redefined a lot of the business ends of it. And look at golf and Tiger Woods. 3 years ago, I think people looked at the billion-dollar man who fell off of a ladder. And golf, they said, may, you know, crumble because of Tiger. It certainly has taken a hit, Paul, but it's nowhere near crumbling. I just people have to start to realize that another athlete will come along. The media is who can destroy anything, because the media will put a story out.
But yes, you're saying that I'm gathering, I guess, you're pro-owner in this situation. You're saying the players are going to have to give something back, and it looks like they're going to have to give something back. But my thing is, why should they have to give something back when the reality of it is they are a part of growing? They have grown the game to this point and have continued to grow this game of football. They have grown the game. And so if you're a big part of growing a business or anything, you want to be compensated for that, and rightfully so. I mean, if Jeremy, grow your business, you deserve to be compensated for growing your business. These players have grown the NFL. They have made the NFL bigger than it was, than it has ever been. I mean, they're one of the reasons that the NFL annually makes $9 billion. They are one of the reasons. The players are a big part of why the NFL is doing so well. So the players deserve some credit here, and the players deserve to have a piece of that pie. How much of the pie? We'll see. I mean, we'll see what's going to happen, whether it be 50-50, whether it be 55-45 in terms of the owners. Will it be 60-40 as it is presently now? I mean, what will it be when it's all said and done? I have to think that when it's all said and done, it probably will end up 50-50 or something along those lines. I mean, they have to work it out. That's really the bottom line. They have to work it out because you have the golden goose right now, which is the NFL. I mean, not too many businesses can say that at this point. So they have to work this thing out and come together. And do I think they will come together? Yes, because, again, if you're missing games, people are missing money, people are missing paychecks, and then you're running into a whole nother situation there.
Let me just give you, and I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into your plan, because I'm going to say something we really never spoke about before, but I think it's been very minorly played. While the NFL has this injunction against them, it pretty much came out, Paul, and I'm sure you remember, they decided between, I think, the owners to collude and to withhold, you know, billions of dollars or to escrow billions of dollars, recognizing they were going, if you read between the lines, they were looking at this as a long-term strike because they held so, $4 billion, you know, in a fund, so to speak, to allow them. You say no one is making money. Well, the owners saved, and deferred a fortune to get them through.
Well, also, I know they tried to get that TV money, that $4 billion TV money
that
they would get if there is a lockout. But I know the Judge Doty put a little monkey wrench into that one. So that may not be happening.
But, Paul, that's my
specific question. He ruled in favor of the players in that case. So, therefore, the owners would be missing out on some money.
No, they're not. Because here's the – Paul, they deferred. So if you understand what happened there, they deferred that money. In deferring that money, what that means is they told the NFL, we don't want you to pay us until, like, next year, and, you know, without letting them know why, which was – because they're planning on a strike, and inside of that strike, they looked and they knew, they must have known that they were going to basically make it their mission to sit around and get this deal done. They're going to strong arm or attempt to strong arm the players' union to show them, because of financial reasons, they can outlast them in a strike situation.
But I mean, in terms. Yes, but in terms of that $4 billion, that was something they took to court with Judge Doty. And basically, at that point, you know, the case is still going. It's still an ongoing case. But as of right now, that was a win for the players because the money that they were supposed to get, the owners were supposed to get, that $4 billion, is no longer going to the owners at this point. And at this point, they're trying to determine what is really going to happen with all that.
It's all, right, but Paul, when you're on a dial in, buddy. But that's going to show you, if you read between the lines, that's going to show you this ownership group had intentions of making this a longer term strike than what you know when you look between the lines, when you see what their intent was. The ownership wanted to make this a potentially a long term strike to wait these players out, because the owners have obviously saved the money. Your stance is going to be that, well, now they don't have the money that they wanted to have. It's not going to change. The bottom line is, Paul, they're going to have to wait to get their money. They're getting that $4 billion one way or another. But I think it's quite clear now when you see this, that when they, you know, the ownership has to be more – there's less owners than there are players. So the disparity is probably what? There's, 5,000 professional football players in total, and there's 34 owners, maybe 50 max when you include the limited, you know, the majority limited partners. So when you look in terms of the numbers, the 50 owners, Paul, have to, in theory, have essentially a more buoyant financial situation than the 5,000 players whose sole income predominantly will depend on their ability to play football. Many of these owners, Paul, as you well know, this is not their bread and butter. They got, like, Jeff Lurie got this because he's got a rich mom and dad.
His situation was he came for money, he bought the Eagles for $185 million, a bargain at the time. I mean, that's a bargain then, and you look at it now, I mean, that was a great investment. It wasn't a bargain. Actually, it was one of the highest paid monies for a franchise at the time. But $185 million.
And Paul, you really
look at his franchise now, he's what? It's a franchise close to, I believe, worth over $1 billion at this point. He's a $1 billion guy. So,
right.
I mean, that's a great situation for Jeff Lurie. That was a great investment. It's a great investment.
Well, it doesn't get any better than that investment. Paul, so when you look, and when you look at the fact that the most now of these players, do you think they're as well placed financially as the ownership group is?
No, not at all.
So,
I mean,
in a strong-arm negotiation that can last months, you know, that's why I say, to a certain regard, you know, the players, whether they're, and that's a situation to me that few people really do remember. Life isn't fair, Paul. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, there are haves and there are have-nots. I mean, these players have to start, I think, being a little bit more realistic. If they really believe that they are that important, go set your own league up and do it yourself. And see, compare yourself to Daniel Snyder. You know, compare yourself to a guy like Daniel Snyder and see, you know, if you will have that ability.
I mean, you're right. I mean, yes. The ownership group obviously can last a little longer than the players. Obviously. Now, some
a little longer?
They have debt. Some of them have debt services they have to pay, but in some stadiums and all that. But, I mean, because of some of the stadiums they built and so on and so forth. But, again, you're right. Owners can last longer, a lot longer than the players could in this whole situation. That's very evident. That's very obvious. I agree with you. They can definitely hold out a lot longer than the players. And we'll see how long they hold out and how long this thing holds out and how long the strike goes as lockout at this point. But I think, and I started this conversation saying this, and I'll also end this conversation in saying this. I think that when it's all said and done, no games will be missed. Maybe a mini camp or two may be lost. A couple of OTA, mini camp and OTA may be lost, yes. But when it's all said and done, football will be played in September at the appropriate time when it's time. The schedule will not change. Everything will be fine. Games will not be missed. And all these things will be taken care of. Because, again, there's too much money here at stake for this not to happen. Too many people eating very well right now for this not to happen. So I think when it's all said and done, the NFL, the NFL Players Association will come together. They will, and ultimately they will come up with some kind of deal, or whether they may not come up with some kind of deal. Maybe they'll end up still dealing with the same old collective bargaining agreement that they have in place now. But something will come about, and they will be playing football on Sundays in September and lasting all the way till February. Best believe that, because, again, too much money is being made by both of these parties. And when there's all this money being made, when money's out there, there's an opportunity money could be lost. People find a way to come together and find a way to make it work. And I think, all said and done, the owners and the players will make it work. They'll make it work.
Well, that's the at the end of the day, and I think that's where we both agree, Paul. That's the one piece of this that you have to rest on. No one can really be this stupid.
You look at right. I mean, no.
Well, but I'm telling you, Paul. I look at this, and I'm telling you, you look at the growth of other sports because now, I mean, they're patronizing themselves. Everybody, you know, the NHL, the NBA, everyone has their own network. The NFL will always have a place in the fan's heart, a special place. It's a different game than the other sports. I think they rely and they live and die on the fact that they only have and there only is, to a certain degree, so few games. It's where they make their bread and butter. And the fact that I think that the league in and of itself has always been, I think, the most well-managed. And to that end, you know, there will be a point where, you know, that league will stay on top as it has. But when you get into, if they get into not playing games, especially as this will continue to get uglier and uglier and uglier. The players are decertifying, and they're talking about, well, you know, should they win this? They're playing it smart. They want to go right back to work. They want to be in the minicamps. They want to at least play through the negotiations to try. They're being locked out, which, you know, I have to say, though, if I was an owner, I don't know why I would resist, why I'm so against that, because it at least favors their ability, you know, certainly, if you will, to show the fans that they, too, meaning the ownership group, want to play football. It's going to be hard to defend, in my opinion, not at least attempting to sit at a bargaining table and when one group of people is saying, hey, we were locked out. We didn't go on strike. We may have and we would have played without a contract. We were never – that opportunity was taken away from us. And that's why I said I think, you know, the ownership group should, to a certain degree, tread somewhat lightly here because that is a very dangerous game to just sit there and assume or to say that you know, they are now not – they separate themselves, I think, from reality because reality is they did lock the players out. And as that comes closer, you know, the court hearing and hearing the players say, hey, listen, while we don't have a contract, we're certainly willing to, you know, go out and play football.
And you're right, and hopefully, again, well, I know they'll come together and make this thing work because they have to, because too much money is at stake. And I know, and I believe, well, I'm not going to say I believe, I know that they will work this thing out because, again, it makes dollars, so therefore it makes a lot of sense. And that's the bottom line. If it makes dollars, it makes sense. And if dollars and cents will be lost, then guess what? They'll find a way to make it where everybody eats and continues to eat and continue to eat very well. We're expected to be joined shortly by actor Quinn Smith, played Lupus on the hit movie, The Bad News Bears, and baseball is around the corner. Baseball is close, very close. I mean, baseball could be here, and we're talking another week or so now, baseball will be started. And Bad News Bears is a classic movie, and hopefully your team will not be like the Bad News Bears. And hopefully your team will play some good baseball. Hopefully your team will go very, very far. My team, which is the Philadelphia Phillies, the team that right now is struggling with a lot of injuries. Brad Lidge will start the season on the DL. Chase Utley will start the season on the DL. And so all these guys will start the season. And two very important guys, and you couple that with the loss of Jason Wirth, and then you have a situation with the lineup. The Philadelphia Phillies lineup, which could be not the lineup that we all know and love. So, I mean, it could be some issues there in Philadelphia, but luckily, you have an Oswalt, you have a Holiday, you have a Hamels, and you have a Cliff Lee, and you have a Joe Blanton, who's a very, very, very good fifth starter. So you have some pitching. So hopefully, they can get some pitching early on. Hopefully, we can get some long games, some six, seven, I mean, talking about seven, eight inning starts from these pitchers, maybe some complete games if you don't have a closer. And hopefully all those things can come together, and hopefully things will work out. Let's bring in now actor, writer, director, Quinn Smith. Quinn, how are you, sir?
Hey, what's up, man? Sorry, I was trying to get a hold of you earlier, but I'm blind, so I don't know how to use phone.
Well, we got it all right, and it was a pleasure having you. Now, Quinn, you're a guy who played Timmy Lupus on the original Bad News Bear. I mean, you were very young when you shot that. 4 years old, you were telling me.
Yeah.
How did you get that role?
It's actually a funny story. The Bad News Bears was... In the 70s, they didn't do a lot of independent movies. That was one of them. and they cast a kid to play the Lupus character, and he got sick. And they had all their money out, the Tatum O'Neill, Walter Matthau, Jackie Earle Haley. So Michael Ritchie, the director, is freaking out. He's got all these people. He doesn't have a kid to play this role. And he sees me in a park, comes up to me, is like, hey, where's your parents? So I'm freaking out. I'm like, here's some strange guy, old guy coming up to me asking where my parents are. I'm about to get molested and raped and all that. So I point at my parents, take off. He goes up to him. He says, hey, look, we're doing a movie. And we're from a small town originally. We're from Snowflake, Arizona. And there's really a town in Arizona called Snowflake. Actually, at the time, it had no stoplights in the town. That's how small it was. So they pretty much were like, yeah, sure, this is really going to happen. But one thing led to another. I got offered this role, and the rest was pretty much history there. They talked to him. He convinced them to do it, and the movie turned out to be a little bit more than an independent.
And thank goodness you weren't raped, molested, or any of that at that time. Now, Quinn, before that, did you do any other acting work?
Yeah, I did. Before that or afterwards?
Before then.
Before, no. We were actually just on vacation in San Diego at the time, so, I mean, I literally had no acting experience. I mean, I didn't even know how to read and write at the time. So,
wow.
But,
so it sounds like it was just a fortuitous situation. Right place,
yeah,
right time.
Yeah, it was lucky in a way and unlucky. I mean, the luck part was, yeah, I got the role. The unlucky part is the rest of my life I got to be known as Lupus. So.
Talk about that, if you don't mind, Quinn. Because I think it's fascinating when people say that, and someone may say, oh, you know what, you were a child actor, and you're in one of the most memorable movies of all time. But talk about your experience and what that maybe meant to you, though.
I mean, it was, it had its good side and its bad side. The bad side is, growing up, people didn't know me as anything but Lupus. You're Lupus. That's what you're known as. So that was the downside of it. Because you kind of, when you're a kid, you want to be your own person. You don't want to be known as somebody, especially some character that's famous for picking his nose. So it wasn't that great of a thing, but it did have its good points, because in the movie we cussed a lot. So I did get away with a little bit more things. Like second grade, I cussed in class, and the teacher was like, got all mad, and she's like, do you talk like that at home? I'm like, lady, did you see the Bad News Bears? Of course. I get paid to talk like that. So, I mean, it had its ups and its downs.
And you talked about being so young and being on the set. Obviously, you don't really remember much from being on the set at that time, correct?
No, I don't remember too much of it. I mean, I've done a couple appearances with some of the other cast members, and then we talk about it, and then it kind of, you remember some of the stuff. But, I mean, I don't remember too. I mean, I did other stuff after that. I did some movies. I did a TV series called The Baseball Bunch with Johnny Bench and Tommy Lasorda. That was back in the 80s where Johnny taught us how to play baseball, and every week they'd have a different baseball player on there, and Tommy Lasorda was the wizard. I remember those, but Bad News Bears kind of, I mean, not really.
And Quinn, it's funny, we hear all the stories about some of the issues that childhood actors suffer in Hollywood. Many get involved in certain things, drugs and things of that nature. How difficult was Hollywood for you growing up?
It wasn't that bad. I mean, a lot of my friends had trouble. Actually, my best friend died last year from his lifestyle was Corey Haim. So, which,
wow.
In fact, we actually, on April 10th, we're premiering his final movie, Decision. So,
okay.
It's going to be a tribute, and we're kind of paying homage because the Oscars and SAG were kind of jerks. They didn't put him in the memoriam. And I don't understand their thinking, because this is a guy who made over $1 billion in movies, but they don't put him in the memorial saying he wasn't big enough. I was watching CNN last night. Matthew McConaughey with Lincoln Lawyer just made that his movie finally put him over the $1 billion mark for grossing movies. Everybody knows Matthew. If he died today, he'd be in the memoriam. But because Corey had some problems in the past, we're not going to put him in there. So
right.
It was good and it's bad. But we're trying to do something for him at this movie premiere with this movie to kind of give him the farewell that he should. But, a lot of the child actors, they just it's a problem because the directors and stuff want these kids to be up. You're working 16, 17-hour days on set. So they will give you drugs to keep you calm, to keep you awake.
Wow.
So that's the problem with Hollywood.
So that's it's interesting when you talk about that. You know, you can be 7 years old, 10 years old, and some doctor it got you to be prescribed a drug like to keep you awake or to keep you energized or to keep you calm. And then when you are done the movie, does that just go away and now, the actor or the star has to either go out and get it on his own? Or does that stuff, kind of just continue? People are kind of still peddling those things your way? Is that how the addiction starts?
I mean, I don't know. I never did the drug scene. I'm probably the first person you've ever talked to that's never drank, never smoked, never used drugs in my life. It's never been something that
two of us.
It's never been something that I've wanted to do, that I was ever interested in. So, I mean, I don't know how that went. I know, like, for instance, one thing that happened with Corey, they would tell him, "Hey, don't do drugs, don't drink," and then hand him drugs and alcohol. And
it's
Hollywood's kind of hypocritical in that way. That's one of the big reasons I try not to do any more acting. It's just because it's they do a lot of stupid things. So, I try not to get involved in anything with the hypocritical. I try and distance myself from anything negative and, that's one bad thing about Hollywood is everyone focuses on negative now. For some, I don't understand it, but that's just one of the things. So I don't know if I'm making sense here. It's a really hypocritical business now. They'll do whatever they can to make a buck.
It's interesting to hear you as I think someone who certainly your movie was an iconic movie, and your take on Hollywood, I think, is to be very respected. And I can't say I disagree. I think a lot of times, especially you look at this Lindsay Lohan, and I think people do forget that they don't. Most childhood actors don't really choose to be that person. It's very much chosen for them, but then they're kind of left to deal with all these assorted consequences. That come with something that again they don't choose, and they're judged and ridiculed because they have problems that again they didn't ask to do any of that.
Right. Well, I mean, some of us are forced. I mean, I wanted to get out of the movies right after the first movie. They wanted me back for the second one because the Lupus character became big. So they asked me to come back. Little did they know I grew a foot and a half over the time from the first movie to the second one. So that's why if you ever notice in the second movie, I'm in bed with a cast on my leg throughout the whole movie. The only reason that is when I showed up on the set, they had to rewrite it. They've already paid me, and I'm taller than everybody. They're like, we don't know what to do now. This, you grew. You're supposed to be the little runt. You're not supposed to be bigger than everybody. So, when they wanted me to do the movie, my dad came to me and was like, "Hey, would you be willing to do this next movie?" I was like, "I don't want to act anymore. I'm done." So he goes, well, let's go camping. We'll think about it after the camping trip if you decide. So we go camping, and he asked me while we were out there, he's like, did you have fun? And this is one of the memories that stuck in my head because it's such a traumatic thing for it to happen to a kid. I was like, yeah, it was a lot of fun camping. We got to do it again. He goes, well, you know, if we don't do this movie, this is where we're going to have to live.
Wow.
Now, if you're a kid and you're taking away TV, you're taking away a room, you're taking away the friends, you're putting someone in a tent, yeah, kids love that stuff, but they don't want to live there. So
right.
He kind of forced me into doing another movie. And then it always sat in the back of my mind, if I didn't keep on doing the next thing, what's going to happen?
And this is that all too often, we have, certainly when you hear many of the childhood actors, this is all too often the theme that, you know, predominantly there is some driver, usually one of the parents or trusted, you know, family members that certainly are you know, putting it in their head that either they can do this and it's going to help the whole family, or without you, we're not going to be able to survive. And at 4 years old, at 6 years old, at, you know, at 8 years old, even at 14 years old, emotionally, that pool, you have to, like you said, Hollywood, or if it's in vogue to now, even at 18 or 23 years old, to look at a young lady who was in movies, you know, before she was 10, but wonder, you know, and look at her parents. And wonder why she is the way she is, and then to kind of ridicule her, you almost have to have a level of empathy, you know, for that.
Well, I think nowadays, I think SAG's starting to work with the kid actors a lot more to make sure that they're not in that position because of how bad the 80s and 70s actors have turned out. Because when you think about actors back in the early 40s, 50s, Shirley Temple, stuff like that, those people were able to do something with their career. You don't hear about those people having troubles. But once the movie started to go rampant in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot more kids put in the movies, and SAG didn't really care. They didn't monitor over stuff. So now you're seeing these people going to prison, going to jail, using drugs, and I think they're starting now to start looking after these kids, pulling them off to the side. Are you happy? And I've got a lot of kid actors that I talk to on a daily basis. And, I mean, these kids, they want to act now. I don't think, I'm not really seeing the forced into it as much with the kids. But then I'm seeing people that do still do acting that were actors that were forced into it back in the day that, the reason they're still doing acting and stuff is just because of they can't do anything else. I mean, you don't want to go in the Radio Shack and be like, dude, I used to watch you on Seinfeld. You're going to be embarrassed. And so, I mean, imagine walking in the Radio Shack and you got Costanza in there trying to sell you something because he doesn't want to act anymore, but he has to have a job. He's going to be embarrassed every day.
No, it's a very, you raise, you know, a very, I think, interesting, you know, point that, and it's for, you know, for any actor, I mean, for any, at any age to be in, you know, a major, either TV show, motion picture, and, you know, and then have to reconcile where they go next, you know, it is very, very difficult.
Yeah. It's an interesting business.
and speaking of that, Quinn, I mean, you have now become a successful writer in Hollywood. It's very obvious in speaking to you. You obviously enjoy the writing side a lot more than the acting side.
I don't do too much writing anymore. I mean, I've done a little. I did a lot with Seinfeld. I do a little bit of writing. It's just I've lost the skills. And I know it sounds odd, how can you lose the skills of writing, but I've lost it. So now I do an occasional project. I'm doing one called Thank You to Our Troops, and what it is we're sitting down with celebrities, James Franco, Robert Redford, and we're just having them talk about how a family member, a friend, was in the military and what effect that had on them. We're going to release it, and it's 100% profits will go to the military. It's going to be, I'm not doing this for the money. This is more, I'm doing it to kind of get back to the military and give them something overseas that they could see, hey, look, every military person knows that regular everyday people appreciate them because most everyday people have someone that's in the military. And they don't really see celebrities telling how the military affects them. And, I mean, the world's vain now, so everybody's all into the celebrity thing. So if the military can actually see, hey, look, these celebrities, these are household names, going, yeah, I had this happen with the military. It's putting them on the level of someone that's associated with the celebrity to where they're starting to feel a little bit more good about themselves and what they're doing. Because even the celebrities have instances where pretty much that they had issues with the military that were positive. So even if it's a family member who died in the military, there's always something that we're getting out of this program to show a positive to it.
We're talking to Quinn Smith, actor, writer, and Quinn is known for playing the role of Lupus in the Bad News Bears. And right now, Quinn, the Bad News Bears, the reunion is being shot right now. You're returning as Lupus. I know it was difficult talking about how you really did not enjoy the acting and you really didn't really want to be a part of it. So how did they find a way to get you a part of this one?
Jackie Earl Haley. He got on me about it. A lot of the actors from the movie wanted to do the acting. They're having reasons that they really want to be back into it. And the only way this movie can happen is to have the original cast that's still alive back. So we have one that didn't want to do it. So the Ogilvy character has been replaced. That's the only replacement. And then Chris Barnes, as you know, has been replaced because he passed away. So the Tanner character has been replaced. So, and that's one of the Coreys is playing the Tanner character, Corey Feldman's Tanner in this. It's an interesting movie. It's not what you're going to expect. If anyone's seen the movie Sex Drive where everything happens that you weren't expecting to happen, that's sort of like what you're going to get with this. You're going to watch it and you're going to be like, I never saw that coming. I never saw this coming. It's interesting. So it's one that you may not want to bring your kids to the first night. You might want to watch and decide if this is something you feel your kids should watch.
And I'll definitely take your word on that one, Quinn. I mean, was it fun being around a lot of the guys again?
I talked to a lot of them, and so I'm not really too much of a people person, so I don't know if I'd say it's fun, because a lot of them talk about the memories from being on set because they were older. They were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 when we were filming this movie, so they remember this movie vividly. They still have the memories, and when they're doing stuff like, oh, do you remember when we did this? And everyone's, oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm just sitting there going, yeah, I have no clue. Because I just don't remember it. It's like,
right.
I get at autograph shows, I have people that will come up to me and they'll be like, do you remember this? And I'll be like, yeah, no. Do you remember your kindergarten? It's like, no, I was 4, I was 5. Okay, I was the same age. I don't remember it. And then I also get the, you were such a cute kid, what happened? I've had so many embarrassing things happen when we do these, we did the National Sports Card Show. We did a reunion. And a lot of us got together and signed autographs for charity there. And I remember the one that killed me, this really cute girl came up. I mean, I'd say 18, 19, 20 years old, and talks about how she watches the movie a lot, and it woke us up with how old this movie is, but how legendary it is. because I looked at her. I was like, oh, so you're a big fan? She's like, no, my mom was when she was a kid.
It sounds like it made us feel old, but
then it also shows that you've got the parents are such big fans that the kids know about how much they were a fan of this movie. So
when can we expect this movie to be released?
I have no clue.
Okay.
Right now, there's one hang up with a pro team that we're working with, and once that's settled, we'll crank out the last parts of the movie. Once we have that done, it's pretty much a wrap up. We've got a great director. We got Martin Gigi, who directed a lot of National Lampoon stuff. We've got a producer who's producing the movie who was just nominated for Academy Award. Can't really say who, but you'll see. He's probably going to do a cameo in the movie. So I think it's going to be a good one. It's a hold right now on the pro team. There's a professional baseball aspect to this movie, which we can't really get into, but all I can tell you is one of the Bad News Bears became a pro.
Hey.
So, we can't say which ones, but we can say that one's a pro. There's some pro baseball players filming this movie. Some names that you'll remember, some names you may not remember, but it'll be an interesting movie. And it'll probably be my final movie. I think I'm going to go out with this movie and then just acting 100% behind me.
And that was my last question, but you answered it. This is it for you.
Probably. I mean, I have one goal, and it's never happened. A friend of mine, James Franco, actually said he would do it this year at the Oscars, and he didn't get the win. But my goal is one day to have everyone say, I'd like to thank everybody but, and have my name pop right in. Because I think it'd be the funniest thing ever. If someone got up at the Academy Awards, wins the Oscar, no one's ever said, I want to thank everyone but someone. They always just thank people. And I just think it'd be hilarious to see. Do it.
Well, I want to thank everyone who listened and who was a part of this show but Quint Smith.
Yeah. But it's better at the Academy Awards. Because here you could say it. There, I mean, here, you could probably even cuss, but I haven't done it, I hope. I usually cuss a lot, so I've been trying to watch it. If I did let one slip, I'm sorry. But, you know, it happens.
Well, you did very well here, and it was greatly appreciated. And, Quint, where can we find out information about some of your projects?
Nowhere, I don't know. I don't really use any of the stuff out there. I mean, like, there's an IMDb page on me, but I don't really care about it. Even though it's got a great photo, it's a picture of me and Jerry Ferrara, who plays Turtle on Entourage. I just love that photo. I don't really put anything out there because I'm trying to, like I said, I try and be forgotten, not remembered.
Right.
So I don't really advertise who I am. I'm not the kind that you can meet walking down the street and expect me to be like, hey, let's reminisce about the movie. I'm the kind that you meet on the street and you'll want to reminisce about the movie and I'll want to walk away from you. So, I mean, it's nothing against the fans. I mean, I'm glad the fans liked the movie. I mean, it was a great movie. I'm glad they're all happy with that. It's more of a thing that I want to distance myself from things that I don't like. Because if you don't like it, all you're thinking about is the negative of it.
Right.
I try not to think about negatives. I try not to worry about other people. I just try and do what I'm doing for me. And kind of just try and stay positive about things. Because life's too short to be negative. And, I mean, it's just one of these things I like to try and have fun with life now.
And, Quint, it was a pleasure. We had a lot of fun with you today, sir. We wish you nothing but the best of luck on the Bad News Bear, some reunion movie, and all your other projects that are out there, and we wish you nothing but the best of luck and continued success in your life.
All right, cool. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Have a good one. All right. Bye-bye.
Quint Smith, known as Lupus, off of Bad News, Off the Bad News Bears, a legendary movie. And it was interesting talking to this man. I mean, he really, really wants to be. He's the anti-Hollywood at this point of his life. And that's interesting.
No, I was... Those stories, I guess you could listen to something like that for a while, Paul. It's certainly quite interesting to hear, you know, a real Hollywood story instead of the one on E!, you know, that's certainly written and so on and so forth. It puts a different perspective on, you know, would you really want to do, you know, what obviously most kids or people say that's their dream in life, is to be an actor or an actress.
And essentially, he was a celebrity overnight. I mean, he was, if you heard his story, I mean, he was picked up in the park, basically.
Yeah.
And he's picked up in the park and basically turned it into what, you know, Lupus, a legendary character. And I guess it would be difficult to try to distance yourself from that character because everybody remembers you for being that guy. And that has to be difficult, and you can kind of understand where he's coming from with that one. But you got the sense that he really is not Hollywood at all.
Well, you know, and I think the one thing he brought home for us is that if it's not, certainly at 4 years old, too, like when you're four, I think it was very interesting, he comments that, like when people ask him of his... you know, likes or dislikes, the first thing that he said to us was, well, what did you remember about being in kindergarten? Very few people remember that stuff. So I think that it was a very, I think it brought it home for me to wonder and think, you know, if I'm 4 years old and I'm in a movie that they don't know that he didn't know what that movie was going to be or what it was going to mean, but he had to kind of deal with the consequences of that.
And, yeah, I mean, yes, and I don't want to say it's a sad story because he did obviously benefit from it, but, you know, just some of the means, just some of how some of the things happened and some of the ways he was put on the set and how pretty much, you know, as a child, you work all those long hours and you do all those things, and you're a mere 5, 6, 7 years old, and you're pretty much working like an adult. And all the pressures that come along with it, and, you know, you're a child. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we're children here. I mean, I would love to be on the playground at 6, 7, 8 years old. I don't want to be on the movie set for 16, 17 hours a day filming the movie. And you know, because the money that I may receive from it, I probably won't get it anyway. And the bulk of it will probably go to my parents or whoever else in my family. I probably won't see the bulk of that money. So,
well, the other thing too, Paul, and again, it's certainly, I think it's very interesting, is finding, it's recognizing, I guess, you know, kind of, if you will, you know, these actors, the first 2, 3 movies they make, they may, you know, get the royalties on a movie like that. You may get a lot of money in royalties, but certainly if it's not a movie that balloons, there's really not that much money until, you know, you do hit, you know, you have to become quote unquote a working, you know, child actor, and then your childhood is gone. I mean, there's no childhood. Right? The childhood is taken away from you very, very quickly.
And you could even talk about it in terms of some of these high school players who are dominant high school players on the basketball, football level. And in some ways, I mean, LeBron James, his childhood, and, you know, part of it was his decision, part of it, you know, was it because of his ability, obviously, but his childhood in some respect was taken away. I don't want to say taken away, but, I mean, he probably didn't do the same type of stuff that a 16 or 15-year-old does because of his ability on the basketball court and because of the talent that he had to play the game of basketball. And any other. I mean, you look at these gymnasts, these female gymnasts who get into the sport at such a young age. They're all messed up. I mean, they're figure skating as well. I mean, they're all messed up as they get older because, you know, their childhood was taken away. Their childhood was taken away from them, and, you know, it's difficult. That's a very difficult situation. I mean, obviously, there's a trade-off. I mean, the money's good and all that. The fame, I guess, is good as well. But there is a trade-off, and it affects your personal life, and it affects you as you grow up, as you want to grow up and become an adult. As you become that adult, you still are doing child-like things, because you really weren't given that childhood to kind of get all that stuff out of your system. All that stuff is still in your system, and it affects you as an adult, and that's really not a good thing. I want to switch gears now to the NCAA tournament now. And right now we're in the Elite Eight. It's the Elite Eight time, and ding-dong, the witch is dead, and that's the Duke Blue Devils. They're gone, and, you know, there's nothing more. That makes me very happy to see Duke out of this tournament. I mean, I get pleasure from Duke losing. I'm not a big Duke Blue Devils fan, but Duke is going, so that's always a good thing. And Jimmer Fredette, he's going now from BYU, as they lost to Florida Thursday, and Duke also lost to Arizona on Thursday, so he's going. But Kimball Walker is still here. And Kimball Walker for UConn has played some great basketball. I mean, he was dominant against San Diego State, 36 points, and he's playing some great basketball. It started in the tournament, this Big East tournament, and now he's continuing his success in the NCAA tournament. So he's balling right now, and he's balling out of control. And again, 36 points for Kimball Walker. And he's doing it. He's making it happen for the UConn Huskies, and they are in the Elite Eight. And again, UConn, I mean, the Big East had 11 teams coming into this tournament. 11 teams. They lost a lot. They lost a lot in the first weekend. They lost a lot of teams. And UConn is the last Big East team standing at this point. They're the last Big East team standing. The UConn Huskies. They're the last Big East team standing right now. Last one, last still standing in the Big East, the mighty Big East. And but give Kimball Walker, I mean, the guy is just getting it done. I mean, impressive, impressive, impressive throughout this tournament. And a lot of people are talking about Kimball Walker. And the Butler Bulldogs, Butler, Cinderella Butler, they're back again. They're in the Elite Eight, and they'll play Florida today. And also Kimball Walker and the UConn Huskies face off against the Arizona Wildcats, again, the team that dethroned the Duke Blue Devils. Some good matchups coming up today. And this tournament's been very exciting. I mean, my Temple Owls went out in a way that I thought they should have won that game against San Diego State, but they're going there. They're out. San Diego State did lose to UConn. And right now, I think with the eight teams left, I'm looking at it. I think I'm, you know, from the East Coast, and I'm going to root for the UConn Huskies from this point on. What about yourself, Jeremy?
Well, I mean, I have to say that I definitely agree. Kimball Walker, I think you're seeing he's raised his game. They look like a hero. I mean, they look unstoppable. Because if you go back to the Big East tournament, you know, they ran through the Big East tournament. He owned the Big East tournament. He's owned his own play throughout this tournament. But the loss of Duke, and then, you know, don't forget, you know, as well, Paul, I mean, Ohio State losing yesterday. So there really is no dominant now team that should have won this tournament. I think for UConn, it could be a chance for them to kind of, I don't want to say sneak in, but to a certain degree, that's almost what it would be. They could kind of sneak in and potentially, you know, get a major tournament under their belt. I can say this. I think always this tournament shows you one thing, which is expect the unexpected. That having that documentary on 2 weeks ago, the Michigan documentary, it does remind you that the best teams in these tournaments rarely come out the winner.
And I think it's usually the team that's on the roll. The best team,
yeah.
You look at the NFL now, it's kind of the same way. The teams that are not necessarily the team with the best record, but kind of the team on the roll. Look at the Green Bay Packers, a team that came into the playoffs on the roll. Again, not the best record in the NFC, and they were the last seeded team in the NFC. But again, a team that was on a roll, and they played great football from the end of the season all the way through the playoffs and ultimately in the Super Bowl. And so you look at UConn, they're kind of the same way right now. They're getting it done. And like you said, they went through the Big East tournament, and they got it done there. And Kimball Walker, I mean, you know, he had 36 points against San Diego State. I mean, that was the seventh game for him out of the last nine with at least 24 points or more. So he's on the roll at the right time. The team is on a roll at the right time, and I think this might be the team that's going to ultimately get it done and ultimately get to a Final Four, ultimately get to the championship, and ultimately may raise this trophy. They may get it done. This may be the team that raises the trophy. UConn Huskies, Kendall Walker, I mean, he's getting it done, and he's playing at a great level right now, a great, great, great level, a very high level. And so give him a lot of credit. He's getting it done. And ultimately, the UConn Huskies are getting it done. And ultimately, the UConn Huskies may be the team that raises the trophy and cuts down the net. That may be the UConn Huskies. And how about the buzzer beater last night in Kentucky, with Kentucky over Ohio State? I mean, another great basketball game that came down to the end. And the number one seed, the Ohio State Buckeyes, were eliminated. Brandon Knight got it done. The buzzer beater, a freshman, got it done on the big stage for Kentucky, and ultimately it led to Kentucky getting it done, and ultimately it led to Kentucky getting to the Elite Eight. But Brandon Knight is getting it done, the freshman.
Well, that's awesome, too. That's going to be interesting to see, you know, what Calipari can do there, you know, where or how, I hate to say where, but how he can parlay that, you know, turn that into a recruiting plus for him. He's now in the Elite Eight, and they're certainly a big-time franchise, and you now have to think, like you said, with a freshman coming in, if he could stay till his junior year, they certainly, Paul, look to again, to be a force.
Well, he might leave after this year. He could be going after this year, probably to another year at the most.
Well, I mean, if he leaves this year, it just you hate to see that. It just destroys. I think we're getting off topic of the tournament, but it's almost hard to imagine how you can have a sport where it's basically a 1 year team. It's like a fantasy football team that every year you pick new players.
Basically. And you look at the games on Sunday, University of Kentucky and North Carolina, two legendary programs clashing in the Elite Eight. That's exciting. Two teams clashing together. Two legendary programs, two historic programs coming together and playing in the Elite Eight. That's interesting, and that's going to be a big one. Two legendary programs coming together, the Elite Eight, and that's all you can ask for in the NCAAs. And we'll see what happens there. But North Carolina is a team that's been playing some good basketball, and they blew out Marquette yesterday. And I think North Carolina will win that game. And I think North Carolina is going to have a berth in the Final Four. So, I mean, the tournament's getting interesting this weekend, the Elite Eight now. It's winding down. It's slowly winding down. And it's a lot of good basketball left, but it's almost there. And we had a lot of good basketball in this tournament, just like you get in every NCAA tournament. But it is not the most wonderful time of the year. No, that's coming in April when the NBA, the big boys, when the big boys head into the playoffs. And that's the real madness. The amazing April, which is going to happen. That's where the madness begins, and that's the NBA playoffs. And that's going to be very, 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 very exciting, especially in the East Coast with the Bulls, the Celtics, the Magic, and the Miami Heat, and even the Knicks. I think the Knicks are one of those teams with Amari and with Carmelo Anthony is a team that can scare somebody, but a dangerous team, but a team that you know is not a championship caliber team, but a team that can scare somebody. And I think it's going to be a great playoff, the NBA playoffs. And that's what I'm looking forward to, because that truly is where the madness begins, and that truly is the most wonderful time of the year. And right now you have the Boston Celtics, a team that is struggling a little bit. I mean, two losses at home, one to the Grizzlies, and then also last night they lost to the Charlotte Bobcats after going into the fourth quarter with a double-digit lead. So right now Boston's struggling a little bit, and right now they're two games behind those Chicago Bulls, who are on top of the Eastern Conference right now, who is playing some great basketball. And Derrick Rose, each and every day, is getting a vote from the writers and everybody else for the MVP. Each and every day he's earning votes, by the way he is playing right now. And Chicago Bulls are getting it done. Again, the number one seeded team in the Eastern Conference right now, and probably when it's all said and done, will be the number one seed in the Eastern Conference during the playoffs. So, Chicago playing. They're getting it done. 32-4 at home. So they're impressive at home. 32-4. So they're dominant at home. 20-15 on the road. They're getting it done on the road. 9-1 in the last 10 games. 9-1, including a 3-game winning streak right now. And they're just playing some great, great basketball. And right now in Chicago, they're the number one seed. And I can't say, going into the playoffs, I guess you would have to say Boston's a favorite, but I don't really know who's a favorite. Because I think if I look at Chicago, if I look at Boston, I look at Miami, I look at Orlando, I think any of those teams could beat anybody. Those top four teams can beat each other. Some teams will have more of an advantage going into certain series, but I think all those teams can beat one another. And I think that's what's going to make an exciting playoff.
It's too early. I think we still have too much time to play to worry about favorites. There's too many injuries that certainly could occur and may occur. But you have to look at, and I don't disagree, in terms of the East, because of their relevant experience, you have to look at Boston if they can continue to stay where they're at as a they're the leader. They come out of this looking the strongest. But that being said, and we both know this, Paul, I mean, it's not like it's a guaranteed lock for them.
With the Eastern Conference, I just think it's up in the air. It really is. I mean, it is going to be that competitive. And out West, it's going to be competitive too. I mean, four teams, same deal out West with San Antonio, the Lakers, Dallas, and Oklahoma City. Again, four teams, legitimate teams. And you can't forget about the Denver Nuggets, who are playing some good basketball ever since the Carmelo trade. I mean, they're 7-3 in their last 10 games. They're 15 games over 500. And they're playing some good basketball. I believe they're 12-4 since the Melo trade. 12-4. So, I mean, just like the deal was good for the Knicks, obviously, because you get a superstar in Carmelo Anthony, the deal wasn't bad for the Denver Nuggets. They were able to kind of rebuild, if you will, from that one. Not necessarily rebuild, but, I mean, that trade allowed them to retool and they got some decent parts and decent pieces from that particular trade, and those pieces are paying off in Danilo Gallinari and Wilson Chandler and Raymond Felton and those guys. It's paying off. Those guys are contributing and doing big things for the Denver Nuggets. And right now, the Denver Nuggets are 15 games over 500. 15 games over 500. And playing very well since the Melo trade. Playing very well. And speaking of Carmelo Anthony, he's struggling in New York. The Knicks right now are not playing good basketball. Lost 5 in a row, including to the Bucks last night. So, I mean, one thing about the Knicks, yes, they're dangerous. Yes, they you have Melo, you have Billups, you have Amari Stoudemire, but one thing you don't have is defense. They don't defend. And you can't win championships if you don't defend. They don't defend. I mean, they're 26 in points allowed. Average, you know, they give up 105 points a game. If you don't defend, you're not going to win games. If you don't defend, you're not going to win championships. And they don't defend. They don't defend. You can't win if you're not defending. If you're not defending, you're not going to win. I mean, you can outscore a lot of people, but ultimately, you got to play defense. You got to play defense. You got to play defense. And they gave up 102 last night to the Milwaukee Bucks. They lost at home. Brandon Jennings dropped 37 on those boys. And so the Knicks are struggling. Lost 5 in a row, 2 games under 500 now, and in the 7th seed in the Eastern Conference. Yes, they're dangerous. Yes, they're exciting. But ultimately, they're exciting to watch. They're enjoyable to watch. But if you want to talk about championships, it may be time for the Knicks to move from Mike D'Antoni and his style, which has proven to be exciting, which has proven to win a lot of games, but it's not proven to win championships. Charles Barkley says it doesn't win championships, and I agree with him. You don't win championships without defending. And that's the bottom line.
And the biggest problem too is they threw this team together in the middle of the year. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're not defending. But also, next year is going to be a new year for this team. They have much more time to mesh.
Yeah, true. But do you think Mike D'Antoni's system is a system that's conducive to winning championships?
No. I mean, they had his greatest team, you know, still remain out west in those old Phoenix days, and no, they didn't win then, and that was their. Stoudemire out there. No, Paul, I think we both agree, absolutely not. I mean, it's a style of play. You certainly can understand it, or so on or so forth, but no, period.
And we'll see what happens as the season progresses. We're going to be joined shortly in the next few minutes by WBC welterweight champion Andre Berto as he prepares for his upcoming bout against Victor Ortiz in Connecticut at the Foxwoods Casinos. And, again, that's going to be a big fight for Berto, and a fight that, you know, some people are saying, why is Berto continuing to fight guys like Victor Ortiz, who's coming up from the 140-pound division? Why is Berto not fighting the big guy? Well, Berto's having a hard time getting the big guys in the ring. I mean, he tried to get Pacquiao in the ring. He couldn't do it. And so Pacquiao ended up facing Mosley. So right now, Berto was looking for a dance partner, and he found one in vicious Victor Ortiz. And some would say, okay, maybe Berto should have fought the likes of a Kermit Cintron or Mike Jones, the up-and-coming welterweight. But, you know, I mean, Berto decided, and his team decided, that this is a fight for him. Victor Ortiz, the guy who, yes, he was a junior welter, a weight fighter, but, I mean, his last fight, he came in at 15 pounds over the limit during the day of the fight. So, I mean, he rehydrated after the weigh-in 15 pounds. So this guy has kind of outgrown the junior welterweight division, and this is going to be a step-up fight for him, and it's going to be a big fight for him. And I think a fight Berto gets done, I think Berto continues to move on and wins this fight. But, I mean, this is going to be an interesting fight, a fight I'm looking forward to.
Oh, you know, absolutely. I mean, listen, I mean, it's still going to be a good fight, whether, you know, the pundits are going to sit there and argue about who should have gone next. I think it's going to make for an interesting challenge on both sides. And the big thing is, again, we're starting to see the revitalization, if you will. I mean, you and I are big boxing fans, Paul, and the revitalization, I know I'm certainly happy about, of big-time boxing and big-time fights.
Well, I don't think boxing ever really left one anywhere.
Well,
I mean, people have criticized the sport, but, I mean, you're still getting some good pay-per-view numbers. I mean, Mayweather is still, you know, over a million pay-per-views. Pacquiao doing big-time numbers on pay-per-views. So you're still getting the pay-per-view numbers. And boxing, to me, I mean, people may criticize, and yes, it has its issues, but say what you will, it's a great sport, and sport I enjoy and love watching and love talking about. And now we actually are now being joined by WBC welterweight champion, Andre Berto. Andre, how are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing good. How you feeling?
And now, Andre, you're preparing for Victor Ortiz, who will battle you for your welterweight champ title. Now, Victor Ortiz was a junior welterweight himself, but now he's moving up to face you. And you hear folks talk about, okay, now Berto's fighting another smaller guy again. How do you respond to that?
I mean, if they would see the press conference and they see me, I'm standing right next to each other. You know, actually, he's bigger than me. I mean, you know, his last fight, you know, he came into the ring almost, you know, 160. You know, so he's a, I mean, I feel he was a big 140. And you know, most likely he's going to be bigger than me come fight night. So, I mean, you know, I can't listen to what everybody else says. He's going to come in there ready to bang it out.
And Victor Ortiz is a guy who has a kind of a straightforward style, and he has power. I mean, what does Victor Ortiz bring to this fight?
I mean, it's everything, man. He's you know, he's a tough he's a tough young kid. I mean, you know, he's in his prime. You know, he's hurt probably. Well, he's hurt, you know, pretty much everybody he's been in the ring with, and he has a lot to prove. You know, it's right here. It's probably going to be, you know, definitely going to be the biggest fight of his career. And, you know, he has a little bit of criticism from the Maidana fight. So he definitely has a lot to prove, man. So, I mean, like I said, he's young, he's fast, he's strong. And, you know, he's come with a lot to prove. So you know, it's going to be a good one.
When you fight, you comment he has a lot to prove. When you get in the ring, you step in the ring with a fighter that is looking to make a name for themselves. Does it change the way you prepare?
You know, I prepare for every fight. And, you know, like, it's a huge fight. So, you know, so I'm definitely going to be, you know, aware of that. But like I said, you know, I'm here at our camp, you know, we've been going 100%. And it doesn't matter what he comes with, you know, come fight night, you know, we're definitely going to be ready for, you know, for everything he comes with. So, you know, not have this world title to defend, and I'm definitely going to do that.
And what advantage does Andre Berto have going into this fight?
You know, pretty much just, I believe, and I have speed advantage. Yeah, I believe I probably have the power advantage as well, and just the experience in general. But I think I've, you know, I've fought on HBO more times. I've fought in front of the bright lights a little bit more times. I think I've fought, you know, like to this day, the better opposition than he has. So, and you know, just backed up, you know, just to feel my opponents. You know, I know how that feels. I know how to, you know, rise to the occasion. So, I think that's definitely going to be my advantage.
We're talking to Andre Berto, WBC welterweight champion, as he prepares for his upcoming fight against Victor Ortiz. Now, Andre, you tried in vain to get Manny Pacquiao in the ring. He decided to go elsewhere to face Shane Mosley. I mean, at this point, and you really wanted to get a big fight, and you wanted the big fight, but at this point, why did you guys pick Victor Ortiz?
you know, Big Girl T, he was one of the ones that, you know, stepped up to the, I mean, he stepped up to the plate. You know, we reached out to a lot of other bigger guys, but, you know, the, you know, Shane Mosley, Dakota, Pacquiao, and, you know, he blatantly just came out and said that they didn't want to do it at that point. And you know, Big Girl T, just him just being a young, you know, fighter, he felt it would be a great opportunity to, you know, he stepped up to the challenge. You know, so you know, a lot of people out there, they just don't know what's going on behind the scenes, and they figuring that we're just out here just picking, I mean, you know, just picking these opponents. Now, we're definitely going after the bigger guys, but like I said, Victor Ortiz, now he stepped up to the plate, so I expect that.
And now, you've had others come to Citron One, who's been calling you out for some time now, calling you all different types of names. I mean, how do you respond to Citron?
I mean, I don't respond to Citron. That's it. I mean, I don't respond to Citron. I mean, you know, he can say what he wants to say. You know, I know his team, you know, very well. I know his you know, his backers, you know, behind him, you know, very well. And I know that they're just pretty much just doing this because, you know, I mean, Citron needs a fight, and he's sitting there not doing nothing, and he's trying to get paid. So, of course, he's going to, you know, I mean, they're going to put him up to do these type of things, like try, you know, try to get some things, you know, stirred up. You know, but at the end of the day, you know, this boxing game, is you know, it's all about business. You know, the current Citron, I believe he knows, you know, himself, you know, made him get in the ring that it'll be a, you know, it'll be a whole different situation. But, yeah, I mean, just the fact that the guy really wants to, you know, go in there and, you know, get a check and just, you know, finally get off the bench.
Right. And Andre, we talked about how this is a big fight for Ortiz, but this is a big fight for you as well, because as you said, there are big names out there, the Mosleys and the Pacquiao's out there, and maybe even Mayweather. All those fights could be big. But, again, those fights may not happen if you don't get by Victor Ortiz.
Of course.
How big is this fight for your future?
This fight here is a big fight for me. You know, I'm not taking this fight, you know, lightly at all. You know, HBO, they really, I believe HBO and just the people in general, you know, they really wanted me to, you know, fight someone that was young and that was just as fast and just as strong. And it had that power to hurt. You know, I had that power to hurt me, you know. So now they have it. And it's just set just for a great fight. And I think that a lot more doors are going to open. All goes well, you know, come fighting that.
And Andre, you felt like that you should have been the guy facing Pacquiao. I mean, you and Mosley, I see you guys had a little Twitter beef here or there about the Pacquiao fight. Everything cool with you and Mosley?
What's that?
Everything cool with you and Shane Mosley?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you know, Shane Mosley is doing what he can do, man, and he has a big fight coming up, and I wish him the best against Manny Pacquiao. You know, but you know, the if it you know, presents itself again, you know, we'll see what happens.
And how do you see that fight playing out, Pacquiao Mosley?
You know, it's gonna be an entertaining fight. It's gonna be a very entertaining fight. It's gonna be good to see you know, Manny Pacquiao in there with a kid that's you know, somebody in there with you know, great hand speed, you know, but at the same time, you know, I see that Shane Mosley, you know, he is getting up in age, his punch output isn't like it used to be. So I'm thinking that that Manny Pacquiao is just pretty much gonna outwork him.
We're talking to Andre Berto, WBC welterweight champion. Andre prepares for his upcoming battle against Victor Ortiz, April 16th, on HBO. Now, Andre, how's this training camp been for you?
It's been good. You know, this right here, I mean, I said on my Twitter earlier, man, this is probably one of the most brutal, you know, training camps I've ever had, man. You know, everything's just been going consistent, but very, 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 very hard training, you know, 2 or 3 times a day. And we're just nonstop. You know, I got tremendous small partners. I have 4 great small partners that's just been on my ass. You know, we're just working every day, putting, you know, tremendous work in. And I'm just blessed. You know, we don't have any injuries, you know, quite yet. And you know, everything is going well.
Now, Andre, after this fight, I mean, if you get by Victor Ortiz, you have a mandatory that's out there, Aiden. Now, if you get by Ortiz, do you face Aiden next? I mean, it's not a big name, but, I mean, it's your mandatory. Is that next for you if you get by Ortiz?
I'm not sure right now at this point. You know, our focus is on Ortiz right now, and, you know, we have to pass that test before we think about any other.
And that makes a lot of sense, sir. Now, Andre, we got to get your prediction on this upcoming fight with Victor Ortiz. We know what you bring to the table. We know what he brings to the table. But on April 16th, at the Foxwoods Casinos, what will happen, East versus West? What will happen to
him? There's definitely going to be something very, very exciting that folks don't want to miss. You know, I'm in tremendous shape. I'm extremely focused. You know, everybody was excited about Tim Bradley and Devin Alexander fight that didn't live up to the hype. This fight will definitely live up to the hype. There's going to be fireworks, and I truly believe it will not. Somebody will be going to sleep. So it's going to be definitely you know, entertaining.
Now, Andre, is 147, do you plan on staying there again for the near future?
Yeah, right now at this point, you know, I'm still making 147 pretty easy. My last two fights, I weighed in at 145. So, you know, so I don't have any problem in making 147. And like I said, I think it's still great competition. You know, at 47, at 54, and you know, a lot of the 140-pounders, you know, they're getting big and they're trying to, you know, move up to 47 as well. So, you know, it's a lot of great talent there. So, you know, so we'll see.
Again, Andre, it was a pleasure talking to you. And, again, make sure you check in Andre Berto against Vicious Victor Ortiz, April 16th. Foxwood Casinos in Connecticut. It's East versus West. It airs on HBO, 9:45 Eastern Time, and again, it's a part of a split site doubleheader as you have Amir Khan facing Paul McCluskey. Andre, it was a pleasure talking to you. We wish you nothing
appreciate
but the best in that fight, and we wish you nothing but the best, and we'd love to talk to you afterwards, sir. Good luck.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
WBC welterweight champion Andre Berto, he's getting ready, he's getting prepared, and he's going to do battle with Vicious Victor Ortiz, April 16th, Foxwood Casinos in Connecticut, East versus West is the title of the show. It will air on HBO, 9:45 p.m. Eastern Time, 6:45 Pacific. It's going to be a big battle for Andre Berto if he continues to move up in the ranks in the boxing world. And, I mean, like he said, Victor Ortiz, yes, he's fought at 140 most of his career. But, again, he was 15 pounds. I mean, on fight night against Lamont Peterson, his last fight, which was a draw, he came in at darn near as a middleweight, close to 160 pounds. On fight day, weighed in at 140 the day before, and he rehydrated close to 160 pounds. So, I mean, you know, Victor Ortiz, yes, he is the smaller guy in terms of he's fought in the junior welterweight division most of his career. But he's stepping up to welterweight now. But, again, he was having a hard time making weight at the junior welterweight division. And then it was time for him to take that next step. And that next step was 147 against Andre Berto. East versus West, baby. Berto, Victor Ortiz. Make sure you check it out on HBO, April 16th. It's going to be a good fight. It's a fight I'm looking forward to. I think
it's both fights will be good, but certainly, you know, certainly that fight will grab both, I think, grab plenty of attention.
And, you know, Amir Khan, I mean, that's a fight he should win, going up against Paul McCluskey. And if he can get by that particular fight, what's next for him is Timothy Bradley for a big fight at 140 pounds, and that's going to be a big fight. That's a unification bout, and that's going to be big. Con Bradley. And that probably is going to happen in the summertime. And speaking of the summertime, a friend of the show, Devin Alexander, will be going up against Lucas Matisse on June 25th. And so Alexander is coming back after the tough loss to Timothy Bradley. So Devin Alexander, we will be talking to him at some point before that fight. Best believe that. And so that's going to be a big fight for him. And Matisse is going to be a tough battle. That's going to be a tough battle for Devin Alexander. Matisse, he dropped that Judah in their last fight. So Matisse is going to be a big battle, a tough fighter. Got a lot of power and a lot of ability. That's going to be a tough fight for Devin Alexander. But
yeah,
the fight, I think he's going to, he's got a lot to prove coming off that lackluster performance against Timothy Bradley.
No, I, you're 1,000%. I mean, the big question, I think, is going to be, can, like you said, can he bounce back? And you got to look for him to have a very convincing victory. He's got to, I think, hammer this one home. But, I mean, he certainly has a big upside. And I think he as well as I think the people inside of his camp, I think, recognize and realize, you know, there's only brighter days ahead for him.
And again, it's a big fight for him. And, I mean, coming off that loss to Timothy Bradley, where in a lot of ways his stock dropped to many because of his performance, you're going to want to, if you're Devin Alexander, you're going to have a lot to prove, and you want to prove something in this fight. And you want to come back stronger and prove to the world that, guess what, you still have some ability, that you're still a world-class fighter. And it should be interesting when that fight comes to see how Devin Alexander responds coming off a loss. I mean, that's the first loss of his career. So it's going to be interesting to see how he responds to that, how he responds to coming back from that loss, that lackluster performance against Timothy Bradley. So he has a lot to prove, and usually when guys have a lot to prove, they tend to find a way to try to prove it.
And then, but Paul, like, let's also be honest here. I mean, You're not necessarily worried that Alexander is not going to be able to come up victorious, you know, in that. I mean, Tim, listen, I'm not out there to bash anyone, but he is, I think, a very qualified opponent, and he knows what he needs to do to get the job done, period.
Well, Lucas Matisse, I mean, say what you will about the guy, but the guy's a banger. He dropped that Judah in that fight, and that's a fight that some people thought that he won. So Lucas Matisse has some ability. He truly does have some ability, and don't sleep on him in this fight. It's going to be a tough fight for Devin Alexander. It's going to be a tough fight, another test in his career, his short career. Man, the guy's only 23 years old. But this is going to be a test in this fight against Lucas Matisse, a fight I think he should win, but a test. It's going to be a test. It's going to be a tough fight. It's not going to be a walkover. It's not going to be cake for Devin Alexander in that particular fight. And it's going to be an interesting fight as Devin Alexander returns June 25th against Lucas Matisse. Got another 7 minutes left in the show. And I saw something with Deion Sanders and Dez Bryant. I mean,
come on.
Deion,
you like the National Enquirer?
Deion, who has mentored Dez Bryant since his time in college, has basically said, and I quote, these are his quotes as he told a radio station in Dallas, he's saying that Dez Bryant, he needs help. He needs help. I told the Cowboys from day one that he needs help. Matter of fact, they have a team in place to help him. But you cannot tell a grown man what to do. Those were the words of Deion Sanders as he talked about Dez Bryant. And Dez Bryant was the guy who was issued a warning by an off-duty police officer at a mall, as he requested Dez Bryant to pull up his pants because his underwear were allegedly showed. And I guess Dez Bryant responded with some profanity, and I guess at that point it became an issue. But, I mean, if you look at it, Dez Bryant is saying, and he responded and saying that basically Deion has never come to him as a man to talk about it face-to-face. So Deion hasn't said anything to Dez face-to-face about the whole situation before he went to the radio station or whoever Alty went to talk about it. So if you're Des Bryant, maybe you are a little upset behind. You know, you could be a little upset because, granted, if I have a problem with Jeremy and I'm going to Steve to talk about my problems with Jeremy and I put Jeremy on blast to Steve, but I didn't talk to Jeremy about my issues with Jeremy, at that point I think Jeremy would be upset with me because I didn't come to him as a man.
No, I mean, Paul, the bottom line, I mean, I think the whole story is a joke, and I'll be honest with you. I think it shouldn't be too hard to realize that the bottom line is you can't go out there and talk about people that way for long. You're not going to survive. Deion Sanders was stupid. He should have at least gone, if there really was concern, he should have gone to the player first and at least told him, listen, dude, I'm going to basically blast you in the public. Because I think, if anything, I think you need this wake-up call. But to do it, because to me, that's, like I said, that's the only way to do it. You can't say this outside and then not have the player come out and say, yeah, but Sanders never comes to me. I'm not saying, Paul, that what Deion said, Sanders, wasn't true, but he kind of looks now a little shady because he didn't, to a man, stand up and say to Dez, hey, I'm done. If anything, I'm going to be done with you.
Right. And if these things are true, and if Deion truly did not reach out to Dez Bryant, as Dez Bryant is saying, before Deion went public with his comments, then Deion would be wrong here because, again, talk to the person first before you do anything. And now you put the guy on blast, and you kind of, in a lot of ways, make him look bad. Because you were a guy who was mentoring this man. You were a guy who was helping this man. Now, if you did not come to him first, in a lot of ways, you just put him out there and without even coming to the guy. Now, if he came to him first and told him, you know, this is that, you know, you need this, that, or whatever, and I'm going to talk to someone, this one and that one, whoever, about this whole situation, and he told Dez that, then that's cool. But if he just went to the radio station, told the radio station about the situation, and just put Dez Bryant on blast and just said he was dumb with him and everything without talking to Dez first, then I have a problem with what he did.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again,
it's the Dallas Cowboys, so who really cares? And the whole situation is kind of funny because, I mean, to me, it's like it's almost like a little game of babies acting like babies. So,
yeah, we'll see. We could hear something tomorrow. Deion and Dez Bryant have cleared up their issues. They're back on one accord. You know what I mean? So who knows where the situation will go. But, I mean, you hope. I mean, Deion, if all these things Dez Bryant is saying is true, Deion kind of looks bad, in my opinion. Well, you mentored the kid, and now the kid is not listening to you or whatever. The kid is doing this, that, whatever. Anytime you're mentoring somebody, there's going to be some hard, rough spots. And doing it. Anytime you're trying to help somebody, it's going to be some rough spot. They're not going to be where you want them to be when you want them to be. Now, I'm not saying that's truly the case here, but what I'm saying is it's a process. And I hope that Deion Sanders went to Dez Bryant first before he went anywhere else. And that's what I hope. And apparently Dez is saying that he tried to reach out to Deion, and Deion has not returned any of his call. So who knows who to believe in this whole situation. Who knows? Who do you believe?
But like I said, it's a Dallas Cowboys, so does anybody really care, other than the fact that it's kind of funny that they're acting like babies, right in front of you? I'm laughing at the whole thing.
So we'll laugh and continue to laugh. We want to thank Andre Berto for coming on today. Andre has a big fight coming up April 16th. Against Victor Ortiz on HBO. It airs at 9:45 p.m. Eastern Time, 6:45 Pacific, and it will be in Connecticut, Foxwood Casino. So make sure you check Andre Berto out, and make sure you check him out on his Twitter page, Andre Berto.
and also at AndreBerto.com. We also want to thank actor Quint Smith for stopping by. Quint is continuing to shoot the film, The Bad News Bears, a reunion, a classic film, and they're bringing it back, and we wish Quint Smith nothing but the best of luck. And make sure you check out this show and other shows at blogtalkradio.com/PGAN, and also follow the show on Twitter at GoForItGAN. For my partner, Jeremy Espy, this is Paul Gann. See you later. Hope you have a great day. Hope you have a great weekend. And I hope all is well to you. God bless.